här är Internationell författarscen och jag heter Ida Linde.
Och jag heter Athena Färrochsad och vi är programansvariga för litteraturen här på Kulturhuset Stadsteatern.
Alldeles strax ska ni få höra författaren Adania Shibli i samtal med Balsam Karam.
Varmt välkomna! När jag kom till det stora fönstret syntes det genom rutan hur grymt och godtyckligt vinden ruskade gräset och träden och fick grenarna att böja sig åt alla håll. Medan de darrande bladen vred sig en framåt, en bakåt och var nära att slita sönder av vindens våldsamma lek. Växter gör helt enkelt inte motstånd. De bara finner sig i det faktum att de är bräckliga och att vinden kan göra vad den vill med dem. Tränga in i dem och härja runt med dem och deras blad. Färdas in mellan grenarna och bära med sig ett rasande hundskall som den slungar iväg överallt omkring sig. Och än en gång tillfånga tar en grupp soldater en flicka, våldtar henne och dödar henne på det som ett kvarts sekel senare ska bli dagen då jag föds. Denna oansenliga detalj, som ingen annan människa skulle kunna ta på allvar, kommer att dröja kvar hos mig för evigt, hur lite jag än vill det och hur jag än försöker att glömma den. Detta faktum kommer att tränga sig på mig oavbrutet, eftersom jag är svag och bräcklig. Lika bräcklig som träden som jag ser framför mig på andra sidan fönstret. Kanske finns det i själva verket inget som är viktigare än den lilla detaljen om man vill komma fram till den fullständiga sanningen som inte framgick av artikeln, eftersom den utelämnade flickans historia.
Välkomna till Internationell författarscen. Jag heter Ida Linde och det här är
Athena Färrochsad.
Boken Athena just läste ur heter En oansenlig detalj och är som ni vet skriven av Adania Shibli. Den finns ju som ni hörde också i en fantastisk översättning av Jonathan Morén som vi är väldigt glada är här ikväll. Utgiven av Tranan förlag. Samtalet är ungefär en timma och efteråt kommer det finnas möjlighet till signering. Men nu i samtal med våran egen Balsam Karam. Welcome on stage!
Thank you. Yeah.
This is for you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to Internationell Författarscen. I'm just going to pour some water here for us because we need it, Adania, right?
Yeah.
When we will speak for quite some time. Yes, my name is Balsam Karam, and I am an author and a lecturer at Literary Composition in HDK Valand in Gothenburg. And I am so very delighted to be here with Adania Shibli. And before we start the talk, I will just give a short introduction. Okay, Adania? Yeah. So, Adania Shibli is a Palestinian author, essayist, and a scholar. And among other things, one thing that caught my eye when I did some research on you was that you have made a PhD in the University of East London in Media and Cultural Studies.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that.
Really?
Yes.
Because it's a,
you spent 7 years of your life, and I'm like, what?
Well, everybody who has a PhD don't, you know, it's. another thing, but because I really liked the subject, right? It was visual terror, a study of visual compositions of the 9/11 attacks and major attacks in the War on Terror by British and French television networks. That feels very, very searing for today also. And you are also an author of several nonfiction works and short stories, some of them that are published and translated to Swedish and published in the literary magazine Caravan. And then we have the three major works that we will hopefully touch upon, all three. And I will begin with In Order.
It's funny you say major works when the name of the novel is minor detail.
Well, it's a major novel.
Major minor works.
Yeah, it's exactly. It was more my intention, right? So, the first novel, Missas, or Beröring in Swedish, which was published in 2001 in Arabic and 2018 in Swedish. It is translated by Jonathan Morén. And then we have Kuluna Baidun Bedat el Magdar Anil Hob, or Vi är alla lika fjärran från kärleken, published in Arabic in 2003 and in Swedish in 2018. And it's translated by Anna Jansson. And then we have Tafsil Thanawi, or En oansenlig detalj, minor detail, published in Arabic in 2017 and in Swedish in 2023 by Jonathan Morén. Have I forgotten something that I should mention here?
My childhood.
Please, can you speak of that? Would you like to? I'm quite interested now. But I was thinking we can get to that. We can definitely get to that.
I mean, what can you imagine a childhood of somebody who goes to writing? I'm sure it's a miserable childhood. They didn't play enough and then they end up writing because they're so miserable and lonely. You know?
Of course. And in my case, you know, it's like if it's not writing, then it's the library. You go to the library every day. So yes, I totally get that. So I am hoping that we, during our hour, will really have the time to speak about all three of your novels. But perhaps since it's in the tradition of Internationell Författarscen to focus on the latest, and now it's been a few years since Minor Detail was published, but if you, in your own words, could tell us, what is it? What kind of a book is it? What is it about?
It took me 12 years to to be able to come to understanding what it is about. So I think I can't say what it is about as much as I can say what brought me to it. Mm-hmm. And I think these questions were not so clear. I mean, now I think about them with more clarity because the work is done. But thinking about it, how it is, and the two parts that it came to be, the central question was, what type of literature can be there? What type of writing can be there? In a context like the context of Palestine, where we talk about colonization and appropriation and destruction of lands and also plants, but also of language, even making sense or narrating, it's a difficulty you come to face quite early on. Whereas, how can you narrate? And given the silences and the inability to find the words to relate to that experience, as if suddenly language is not there, is either shying away from you or you're shying away from language. And there's a lot of absence and difficulty. And so you think with this kind of perforated narrative, what kind of writing can emerge? And I think this is was haunting me the whole time without understanding that it will lead me to this book. I was saying earlier, and I know this sounds ridiculous, but it's really sincere. When I was flying, I always was fascinated by the stewards, how they speak. Welcome on board. And you know, you have this voice and this clarity of a language that flows. And I was fascinated by this ability of reciting a text. And that there is a ready language that comes to the rescue of those who inform about things. And I realized that the relationship is not informing about, but creating from within these absences. So I was haunted by these two, the flawless narration, the narration that doesn't stop or is not broken, the one that convinces us, that structure our life and structure our understanding, or actually perhaps it imposes itself a certain rationale, and the language that has no place, that it's so pushed on the side, that is related to as unreliable, inadequate, and disfluency. And of course, I grew up with that. And I come to writing with that. And my question was, what type of literature or a form, a literary form, can come out of that? And there, maybe this is the moment before the writing started. But all these things were not so clear. They were just pressing and haunting me. And talking about unhappy childhood, I actually also faced this when we were kids. I fought with my sister. She's 4 years older than me. And of course, for my sisters and brothers, I was this unworthy creature, even to look at me, like, you know, I'm so little, like down there. But there was one sister, she just liked to fight with me. And I think because of the age, of course, she was, or like, I don't know if I'm objective saying that, but I always felt I'm the victim. So she would fight. And then she really enjoyed to go and to tell the story differently of what happened. And I'm always like, wow, it's amazing how she can invent the story. And I would stand there like fascinated. And I remember this one time we really fought, and my mom noticed us, and she ran to my mom to tell her this amazing constructed story. And I followed her, and I was speechless. And she turned to my mom and said, "You see, even she's speechless." And I, of course, I was fascinated by her perfect story. And then, like, my silence, my mumbling, my inability to come up with a story was like a cause for like being accused. Like, I started the trouble. But for me, I really was fascinated. I think this is one of the furthest memories in my mind of discovering how can fiction can work. Because there's this moment, suddenly you realize there's a different story there, completely different, and it's perfect, and it's beautiful, and structured. And even you're a character in there, or supposedly, though you didn't do any of that. So I was interested in these two different points, that the clear narrative that is seducing, that convincing, that wins, and there is this other loser, lousy, mumbling narrative.
Yes.
But still it's there. So
yeah.
If we go to that and tell this, okay, can you write your story? We're going to give you like 5 years, not 5 minutes. So what is that going to be there?
Exactly. And I think it's very, I mean, we will get back to many things there, because I kind of recognize the story about the children fighting also from your other novels. It's very interesting for me, and it was something. Now, I have been that child who's been accusing others of things, actually. So I'm not going to talk too much about that, but we will get back to it. But for those of you who haven't had the chance to read this amazing book, which both, I mean, here we have it in Swedish as Athena read it, and this is the English. It is composed of two parts. And the first part is the story of that stems from a real event of this platoon and a commander who they find, or, you know, on their patrols, they find this Bedouin girl who they take with them to the camp. And she is being held captive, and she is tormented and raped and eventually killed. And then there is this other story about a woman that much later finds an article about this happening and is fascinated by it in many ways. And this fascination is, of course, this is a part of the thing that makes this novel so amazing, because it's almost obsession in a way, and it grounds in the fact that this woman is born to the day 25 years later than that happening, and this starts something, and it's almost like it starts an obsession. Now, I was thinking about, I mean, you have said in an interview, which I think that you spoke about now also, that you don't like the idea or the thought of speaking about or writing about. You rather would like the idea of writing within. And now you just spoke about, you know, these two kind of narratives, where one is a bit mumbling, and also is very, I think that the woman is very clear with her own faults in a way. Oh, I am a bit too much of this, I am a bit too much of that. But there's also this, the violence of writing from within this commander. And I was thinking about that, if you could speak a little bit about that, why that telling was the preferred one in this case, or and how it made perhaps your relationship to the language, to write from this commander who is really going through a lot of things during this first part of the book.
Yeah, it's a question of the ones who are mumbling, can they ever speak clearly if they in their imitation. I mean, it's about imitating or repeating a language that is not yours, mm-hmm. going to a position that perhaps is not yours, mm-hmm. and can you actually access it, or does it exist within you? Mm-hmm. I mean, I see the officer and his language, or the language of the first part is bringing this. How, if you are coming from a position which I described earlier of erasing language, of language hiding from you as well, and realizing language is also something not just ready there for you. Can you ever have this access to language that seemingly many people have? And I think this is. A position that was intriguing, because if you start writing this way, what kind of acts you will do as well within this clarity? Mm. If you are in this position of power, power in relation to language, I mean, you are in control of what you say, you know what you say, and you have a whole picture, like almost this kind of you position yourself on top of language. So it is a position of language or in relation to language that is away from the intimacy and fragility and vulnerability that you are always accustomed to. So for me, it is perhaps trying to approach this position to language from a character.
Yeah.
What kind of this character would do? And I think this is where I came to this officer. And it's important to think about this officer is not an outside. I mean, for me, going to this level of language and this level of clarity, I perceive it as an act of violence to language. When you come to language to use it, it's like love, you know? Mm-hmm. When you, I mean, I am in love with language, and I treat language or I relate to language as a living being, as a being. So when you are in love with language, can you claim that you use it? Because imagine you love somebody and you say, "I'm going to use you." Mm-hmm. I mean, we will be disgusted from this position. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're going to use me, and the same if we think of language that I'm going to use language, mm-hmm. but I wanted to go into this place, mm-hmm. to this place of having this violence and exploring also a violence within the self. Mm. Because we are not violent. When we use language this way, we are not consciously violent as well as exactly when we cause pain to others, we are not conscious about that. Because the minute we are conscious that we are doing that, I mean, probably somebody can do it and then we're sadistic and we're enjoying that. But a lot of the violence is one that we take as normal. And this is what normalizes violence and cruelty and causing pain to others. And I think each one of us have this possibility of causing pain to others. And I, for me, I wanted to see from perhaps within this position of writing, how this violence can be generated. I don't know if I can say by me, but by positioning myself in a specific relation in writing. Mm. I know it's a bit complicated, but if you know, if I mean my domain is language and literature, as perhaps somebody else is, I don't know, cooking. So you use cooking to cause pain to others, you know, cooking something bad maybe, or I don't know. But you can also come to it differently,
yeah,
in relation to taste. And I think this is for me. So it is, and it was hard, and it was very difficult, but it didn't have the difficulty that was in the second part.
Mm. Yeah.
The first part has this cruel clarity within the process that the second part to gather these fragmentations is more difficult. It's almost like you're going to a scene of brokenness and to walk alongside it and not to force the violence of bringing it together back, but acknowledging this brokenness and being tender with this brokenness and allowing it to exist, because it's also recognizing a possibility, a different possibility than this violence on language, this narrative. I really, I love literature and I love writers and writing, but I hate this classical narrative structure. Mm. I really, it's like, I think before writing this novel, I hated it so much that I was walking the street and saying, I hate narrative structure. I hate narrative, I hate narrative structure.
Well.
And I say, I will never do it. And this is what happens normally. I'm so bad. Like when I say, I am not going to do it, I just go and do it.
Mm. Mm.
So I went and wrote that part.
Yeah. Well, I have so much to ask you about this, because there's something also, you were talking about the violence, of course, and the violence in the book is also in the parts of the, you know, like the surroundings, of course, and especially in the second part with the military checkpoints and the explosions, and there's also many similarities between the first part and the second part, you know, like just going about this desert, but then in the later part there is much more buildings and settlements in this surrounding that before was this supposed to be this wasteland, as they, the commander, calls it. But I was also thinking about that there is in relation to this something that I really, really appreciated with this novel, and that I think kind of breaks from that narrative, is also the humor. Like, you have a lot of humor, especially in the second part. Do you agree?
I don't know. I was really serious writing it.
Okay, because I thought there's something about the absurdity of course, this person, for example. You know, there is the scene where the colleague wants to open the windows because it's going to be an explosion that will target three young men that's barricaded in a building close to this woman's workplace, and she's very irritated because she hates dust, and she knows that the dust will come in from this explosion. And I was thinking about, of course, that there is, I mean, the absurdity perhaps is more than the humor, but there is something about the life of under the occupation, of course, that made it also humorous for me. And so I was thinking about that in relation also to time and speciality in your text. Like, I believe that there is something in this like occupation as a mode or as a time in both these parts, and they go together. So I was thinking, could you speak a little bit about how you've used time in this book?
Yeah, it's very interesting because you know, these words that you refer, that they are shared, that they are almost traveling in time. And the same way of traveling, you know, in relationships, like at the beginning of the relationship, somebody says, you're crazy. And 10 years after...
You just told me I'm crazy there inside.
Yeah, and exactly the two people. And so here we're not talking about a context. Because, you know, sometimes if we go to the context, like if it changes, like, no, we can sit together here, like, as let's say the two people in a relationship sitting together in a cafe. We imagine this in or in their kitchen, around their kitchen table, and they, one says, you're crazy. This is after like 3 days meeting together, yeah? And then 20 years after, and the same person says, you're crazy. And you know this length, you know that the first word, it meant something, and that word meant something completely else. But it's the same word, and this traveling, this is the time where it travels. It doesn't travel in place, but it is in the same place, the same people, but only time passed on it. And for me, this is like, it almost brings this whole meaning is a condensation of this time, of all, like, you know, the almost the love and the first, you're crazy, and the hatred, like, you know, this is coming together, and perhaps this is the last word a person would say before falling out of love with somebody. And this suddenly, the meaning becomes completely different. But the absurdity is within that. It's within this kind of stretch of time. Talking about absurdity, you know, I mean, I remember actually this building that got bombed in Ramallah. And I had a friend, or the boyfriend of a friend, he was living there. And so the military asked everybody to leave the building immediately. And so all the residents were outside. And then for hours waiting, because nobody knows what will happen. The army is there. And then suddenly the military said to the residents of the building who were standing outside, you have 20 minutes to go to the building and to take whatever you want, but 20 minutes, and because we're going to bomb the building. So her boyfriend was living there. And, you know, he had everything there, like his papers, his life. I mean, what do you put in your apartment? And what can you take in 20 minutes? And guess what he took? He took the washing from the washing machine. And this is like, you know, and we didn't believe it. Like, what did he do? Yeah, he just walked to the kitchen, opened the washing machine, took the wet washing and went out. And this is like, you know, you think, and for me, I keep talking and thinking about this incident and how she was talking about it. At that moment, you know, we felt he's crazy, but it's also, you know, we try to say, but yeah, but maybe it was important because, you know, his clothes were there. So you start this absurdity, you start also to give it a sense. And of course, I'm sitting here now and think this is the most ridiculous thing to go to your washing machine. Like, I don't know. I mean, what are we going to take? We're giving 20 minutes to go to the flat and to take. What is it? I mean, do you take your manuscript or you take your papers that prove who you are? Or, I don't know, your money? Or it's like, you know, 20 minutes, how... Yeah, what you gonna do with these 20 minutes?
Yeah. What is a normal reaction to something that is so absurd? Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, of course, he regretted it. Perhaps because we're all like, you know, and you know, he's like, what? Speak to him, call him. What did he do? The washing, and he's not like a young, a reckless man. He was in his 40s. Like, you know, you expect like some.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So. I was thinking about now the title, of course, Minor Detail, because in the book I just almost felt like it's quite important for this for the novel and the structure of it and maybe even the organization of the novel, but there's almost something there's almost a poetics in it, like because the woman says somewhere that. It's very important with these minor details. I think Athena also read it a little bit in the section to understand the truth or to understand the bigger picture. And I was thinking, is there really a poetics in this? Or could you speak a little bit about the importance of the minor details for the bigger picture? For example, in the story that you just said to us, I think.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, you know, I think... there's two aspects of the minor, and we were just speaking about it with a friend this afternoon. I think the minor is what also left for you, because when there's power seeks to take what it considers major. And what's grand, because this is what power looks at. And it's really neglects what it considers meaningless. So you are left with that. That is like after a plunder, this is what remains to you. And this what is unimportant to those who take away things from you is eventually is so important and all what you can cling to, it's almost like a trace. And you know, in Arabic poetry, from 600, there's always al-atlal, like the poem starts on the ruins. So you come to the ruins, there's nothing there. There's like an encampment that where people left. And the poet comes. So the poet is the one who starts bringing life or a different possibility for these ruins. And suddenly these ruins are transformed into something, a new beginning of thinking or being or emotions. Actually, as kids, we hated this a lot, the ruins. We was like always, oh no, not again, these poems. Because they are like 1,400 years, and at school, they thought we should start from the first written poem. So like, you know, you're 10 years old and you're reading this 1,400 years old poem, and you're reading a lot of this poetry that starts on the ruins, that the thing that is almost unimportant. You leave and you take, everything is important, but you leave things which are unimportant or considered like the ashes, the smoke, the stones. And with the destruction of Palestine in 1948, also the remains, the destruction, is what you are left with for those who were allowed to stay in Palestine, Palestine, Israel. And you come to these sites. And it's within these little traces that actually Israelis don't pay attention to, because they are not aware of the story of that. And so we would go to these places and we would play amongst these ruins. And our parents, they took us there, which I don't know why they did it. It's almost like this poetic act of a return to the ruins. Maybe it's a memory that they bring. But they didn't tell us at all what these places are. But we would notice. We would notice there are fruit trees there that suddenly appear in the woods, because the Israeli government tried to cover the remains of these villages by planting trees, by doing like forests. So you don't see them easily. But sometimes when you walk around, you would see a remains of a wall, or a vine tree, or a fig tree, and of course cactus. Cactus is... it becomes so funny, like for Palestinians, that we always joke like, oh yeah, there's a cactus, there was a Palestinian village here. Because there's always these cactus, and because a cactus was also, people used it, it's kind of, you eat from the cactus, it's also almost like guarding you because of the thorns. And it protects you and protects others. So these cactus, they remain there. And our parents would go and pick the fruits. And within that kind of destruction, with the little, that thing, you know, this bulldozer or whatever, that didn't care to destroy completely because it's just a tiny stone. Yeah. It suddenly becomes so a trigger of so many... imagination, because we used to imagine how this could be part of a house. And like returning to this moment, also perhaps going to this moment of poetry that like Umr al-Qais or Antar bin Shaddad, these poets from 6th and 7th century, that it triggers a whole existence of the lover or the family that just left. So I think it's more than trying to find the truth, it's trying to find the literature, a literature or a different type of being.
Yeah,
you don't have a place, like, you know, you don't go and you find, like, you don't go in Palestine and you find a statue of a Palestinian thinker, like, there in the middle of Yaffa. No, you will never find that. But you find a little cactus there, you know, in the corner, like, oh, yeah. So this becomes your, your presence is within that, within the minor.
And it's very, very evident in this book, and it's very beautifully, beautifully done. And we spoke together and said that we have to speak about love.
Yeah, also. We already spoke about love.
Yeah, we have already spoken about love, but could we speak a little bit more about love also? And the thing, before we do that, I would just like to just go into your two other books as well that I've really, really enjoyed and loved, really. And first of all, I would like to describe, like, someone would ask me, how is Massage Berøring, what kind of a book it is, I would really talk about the fragment, you know, that other form that you, you know, the opposite of what you walked around and hated, in a way. There's something very fragmented and extremely, like, they interact and intersect in a way, like almost as a braid, the segments. And then we have your other book, Vi är alla lika fjärran från kärleken, that also has a type of fragment, but where love is really a central point. I would say that love is central in both of them.
Yeah.
But so how do you write about love in these times?
Yeah, actually, a friend asked me that when I wrote it. And but he continued something. You know, sometimes like wisdom to writers or to me comes only after writing a book. So like, it's not something before. That book I wrote in from 2000 till 2003, that was the beginning of the second intifada.
Yeah, vi alla lika fjärran från kärleken.
And I think in 2002, there was the major reinvasion of different Palestinian cities. So I was very present in there. I actually was working with a Swedish TV as a fixer and translator, a lousy one. so whatever news you got there, it's not accurate. Anyway, this allowed me to travel a lot. I think my friends were all stuck under curfew, and I was traveling a lot. And perhaps witnessing things I didn't want really to witness. So every day I came back to my small little house in the old city of Jerusalem. And I was working in this novel. And I think it's a novel that centers itself in this closed spaces. There's nothing major movement. Nobody leaves. And therefore, you don't witness anything outside the space of the home. But perhaps for me, it is the most political book, if we want to think about it now. Because it this kind of the character staying in these enclosed spaces, it was a decision by an external force that doesn't want that out. Mm. And also, it's a moment perhaps you witness the failure of love or the inability to love. Or you would ask, okay, if you are faced with all this destruction, in which way will you love? Or will you still be able to love? And I think the question of love is very difficult in the context of Palestine, because it's about trust and relating back to yourself at a time that the only thing you want to do is to disconnect from any feeling, because you are faced in every minute you're faced with humiliation, with subjugation, with turning you into the person who should be punished. You don't necessarily know why, but the one who is punishing you know very clearly why. Mm-hmm. And this is it's you need to go into this mode of thinking, like, okay. Because it's a kind of alienates you from your experience. You know, you didn't commit any crime, but the punishment is there. So it's not about your experience. So your experiences are no longer important in your being. Your movements are designed by something you didn't choose, the way you, where you go and which friends you see, because suddenly your friends become further because of the checkpoints. It's no longer a 40 or 20 minutes ride, it's can be 3 hours. And you start to say, I don't want to go to see my friends. So this is one absence of a relation or love. And then you don't miss. You should not miss, because when you miss, it's something that will not happen. So you should not miss. So you should not feel. Mm-hmm. And when you are there waiting for some time at a checkpoint, you shouldn't think you are wasting your time and getting angry. No, you shouldn't. You shouldn't feel. So there's everything telling you don't feel.
Yep.
So you are training yourself not to feel. And then how can you love from that point? And I think it's really a difficulty. I mean, I witness it. Like, it's almost like how this destruction comes to something that you thought you can hold, but you no longer hold. You cannot practice. Though it is kind of, as an idea, it's something that it's about your feelings, but no. So it's all these characters who perhaps miss love, but they fail to do that. I'm saying again this now, after writing this book, 20 years after writing this book. Wow, 20 years after writing this book. But I didn't realize all of that. I just was writing it. I was coming back from work or days I didn't need to work all the time, and I was just writing about love or the impossibility of love in the middle of that. And it's that friend who noted this.
So we also spoke about that, because as I said, that book is perhaps, of course, less fragmented than your first book, Miss Ass, but what is it about the fragment, or, you know, that perhaps the non-narrative book that is better than the narrative book? And how come you use the fragments in the first book?
Yeah, I think my difficulty with the narrative is this authority, this power. And so it's like a question, what kind of literature that doesn't imitate power, this the all-knowing narrator, all this kind of, you know, the power that my sister to present this perfect story that you can believe it. You're like, you're so much immersed in it that you think, oh, it's so it's almost real. But I mean, I hope I can do that. Actually, I will tell you something very it's kind of sad, but yeah, we laughed enough, so we can be a bit sad. In the last few months, I was really like trying to think about violence, or what is violence? Why violence? How we come to practice violence? It was a haunting question, and because for me, I always say that if somebody will attack me, I will never rise in self-defense and kill them, because to live with the idea that I kill somebody is not a life I would like to live. Therefore, I of this situation. So I was like divided in that. And then I was, I read sometimes these complicated texts, but I confess. So I was reading Walter Benjamin. He has a text about on violence, and he's critiquing this idea of violence, and especially what happens after somebody kills. It's not like you are questioning if you're gonna kill or not. What happens after the act of killing takes place? What kind of position we will have then? How we will relate to killing? And I was going with this for a few weeks. What happens? So what is it when you are faced with killing? And I was reading the news. I don't read the news, really. I read next to the news. So it's like I avoid reading the news. So I kind of glimpse quickly. And so I read the cultural section. There is this very bad Palestinian newspaper. It's so bad. And I really like it because it's like so bad that it's away from any news, and it's entertaining for me, like how this language, it becomes fiction in itself. So I like to read the cultural section, which is also very bad, you know, like. And suddenly there is a different kind of story appears there. It's the story of a young man. He's 17 years old. His name is Usaid, and he got killed. So the story, or that this is real, supposed to be news. And of course, I immediately rushed to The Guardian to see what The Guardian wrote. And I noticed The Guardian wrote something about that. So we have two stories here. The story of The Guardian that is on the main page and Guardian style, you know. So there's the story where the military entered this village called Deir Ghassana. Mm. And they shot, and then they killed this young man, teenager, his name is Usaid, and you know, whatever the news would be, and the story is finished. But the story in the Palestinian section, the cultural section, tries to reconstruct what happened. Mm. So you have the mother is speaking about what Usaid, before he left in the evening, what he told her, he wanted to eat this food. And then they had a discussion, like, should he take wood? Because he wanted to go with his friends to eat something in the to do a picnic. And he was excited. It was like a Thursday, a Friday. And there is this, his father. This is his mother. So it's the story about the discussion about what they should eat. And he took a shower. So all kind of details. Okay. Of course, they don't appear in the Guardian, and then his father about what Usaid, with which friends he wanted, and he told him, no, don't go to that piece of land, go to that piece of land, and then so Usaid, you can understand from the story, it's not so clear that he did the picnic and he was coming back late at night, so the military entered. And they shot somebody. So he's passing, or somebody called him that the military is in the village. So Usaid is close to that area, and he sees somebody got killed from the village. And what does Usaid do? So his brother is watching. He's on one of the floors around the square. Also some friends. The brother sees Usaid wants to go to help the one who got shot. As he approaches to take him, his brother is up, sees him, and he sees a sniper gonna shoot him. And he wants to go down. The friends of the brother holds him. So the brother describes in this whole section that he sees Usaid. So Usaid is like in a glimpse, and that he thinks about the stairs. Are there, and the text he writes, there are seven stairs, and there's this shop that sells, I don't know what, and this shop that sells. So it's all these unnecessary details. So unnecessary. And then, okay, there's the shooting. We don't, like, it's missing. Nobody, everybody's witnessing it, but no. One describes it, because everybody's focusing on the sign, the stairs, the friends that they hold. So the brother describes how his friend holds him in his arm, doesn't allow him. And then jump, Usaid is shot, and the brother is with him in the car trying to go to the hospital. There's no hospital. They find a doctor. The doctor tries, and this is like, again, the story. Oh, we knocked on the door of the doctor. The doctor came out. It was late. So it's all these details. And then the doctor tells, no, it's better you go there. So let me call. And the doctor was so nice, and he called. And it was full of all these details that the newspaper, the Palestinian newspaper, put it on the culture section.
Oh, yeah.
And it's fascinating. Like, this fragmentation, for those who experience, it's only fragmentation can take place. But news cannot tolerate the truth as it's experienced from the perspective of the victims. It should be that
Yes.
Kind of narrative. Mm. The narrative that I walk in the street and I say I hate. And I think now I'm justified to say that.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, and also it's like also it ended my question, what do you do when somebody is killed? I mean, what Usay tells me and what his brother tells me, you go and help the one who's killed. You know, the Bible tells you, oh, if somebody threatens you, you need to wake up and kill or don't kill, or there's a legal system. But within all of these systems that address the killing, rarely ones tell us, go and help or carry the person who is killed or try to take him or take her. And this is perhaps the fragmented narrative can only tell that.
Yes.
The complete narrative will tell us, no, it's a dangerous zone, don't get close to that, and watch the crime as it unfolds while you're saving yourself.
Yes.
So it comes like, you know, I mean, things get clearer with a day sometimes. You don't have the wisdom, but you're just looking and seeing how others bring, how others put their lives into showing something different. And so I no longer ask, what do I do when somebody is killed? Should I kill them? No, you just help the killed or the wounded.
It's absolutely unbelievable that our time is basically up. But, you know, I know that you're exhausted, Anania, but for me it's absolutely unbelievable. Let's sit another hour. but before you go, I must ask you the must question. Are you writing on something right now?
Yeah.
And? No, I'm just... Well, thank you. It's very happy to hear that. And thank you, everybody, for coming. And most thank you to you, Adania.
Thank
I think
you.
That we will thank continue speaking. Yeah. I will make you more tired. And soon... well, we will have Adania outside so that she can do some signing, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.